The annual point in time count of Oahu's homeless population provides the data on which much of local government policy is based, and the 2017 survey is the most comprehensive one to date, expanding its reach to ask questions and gather information that should provide stakeholders with a greater wealth of detail than they've had before. Earlier this morning, we discussed the 2017 Point of Time Count After Action Report with Partners in Care Director Jennifer Stosch.
I think what we learned is we were able to take the information that we gathered during the 2017 point in time count, and we did a lot of analysis this year. In the past, we really limited our analysis to the data that HUD wanted, which is the federal agency, Housing and Urban Development,
right,
who requires us to do this count. But after meeting with community members and stakeholders and other organizations in the community, we really recognized that this information is very useful and needed for planning purposes.
Mm-hmm.
We have a big problem here. Nobody denies that. But understanding that problem is critical to formulating effective solutions.
What information is most essential to understanding?
Well, I think most essential to understanding is understanding the subpopulations that were surveyed this year. This was the first year in 2017 that we took the race question and we said, check all that apply. When we report this data to HUD, we actually only report this in five race categories. And so we actually looked at all that apply. And what that allowed us to do is get a lot of information about those that reported to be Native Hawaiian. And it was pretty alarming, quite frankly, to see the numbers with 31% of those that are homeless on Oahu being Native Hawaiian.
Well, you know, just, I mean, I have to laugh at the notion of there being only five race categories. Anybody who lives in Hawaii
yes.
knows how
yes.
absurd that is, right?
Yes.
So that right away expands the reach of the information you can gather.
Right, right. And understanding, you know, children. I mean, we found that 23% of the island's homeless population were children under 18. And to us, we went, wow, that's something that we need to look at.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking at these larger numbers and looking at subpopulations that seem to be trending mm-hmm. Is really important for formulating solutions and combating this problem.
Just saying, revealing that that high percentage of children kind of takes away the argument you hear about the homeless as in terms of the decisions they make. They want to do this, they want to do that. Children go where their parents go, right?
Children go where their parents go. And children often don't have a choice to receive services.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Access to services is dependent upon their parents accessing or their caregiver accessing services.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually heard of stories where outreach teams are out there trying to get people to go into shelter and trying to get families to access services and hearing about children that are literally pleading with their parents to go into shelter and parents refusing. And then the children don't go into shelter either.
What kind of reasons are given for not going into a shelter?
You know, there's a lot of reasons given. You know, there's reasons regarding, you know, not wanting to follow rules. There's concerns of safety sometimes. There's lots of different reasons that people don't want to go into shelter. We hear, you know, recently, as we saw in yesterday's newspaper, you know, there's a lot of people that have pets. The shelters don't allow pets. Most shelters don't allow pets. And so most often people will make the choice to be unsheltered as opposed to surrender their pets.
What kind of health care issues do you run into?
Oh, so many health care issues. Mental health in particular, substance abuse disorder, and the combination between mental health and substance abuse disorder is just, you know, a really tragic situation for anybody that's struggling on the street. And when I hear people say that, you know, people choose to be homeless, you know, substance abuse disorder and mental health issues, you know, these are health issues that nobody chooses to have. Addiction is not something that somebody chooses to have. So I think it's really important for us as a community to understand the issues involved and to empathize with those that are suffering. I hear often pointing the finger of blame. I think that's an easy way to take responsibility from ourselves. I think it's really important that when we're looking for who to call and who to formulate a solution to resolve homelessness in our community, the first place we should do is just look in the mirror, because we all have a responsibility to combat this issue.
That's a pretty wide social shift that you're calling for. Are you optimistic about being able to bring it about?
You know, I'm optimistic about being able to bring additional stakeholders to the table to formulate a solution. I think in the past, as far as Partners in Care and just our purpose, we're a membership organization that came about through a federal grant, the Continuum of Care grant that everybody hears so much about. That's basically about $9 million that we have to figure out how to allocate in the community. And right now we allocate pretty much all of that towards permanent housing that goes directly to providers to provide tenant-based vouchers. So with that said, you know, our $9 million to $10 million is a real drop in the bucket as to what is needed to combat this problem. So it's essential that we're partnering with the City and County of Honolulu, that we're partnering with the Homeless Programs Office that, quite frankly, receives most of the dollars to provide homeless services in our community. They fund almost all of the outreach services. They fund all of the emergency shelters. So partnership is really important. And I emphasize that because we've actually this year developed a really wonderful partnership with Queens Medical Center, who reached out to us and said, you know, we're seeing so many people that are experiencing homelessness in our ER. And, you know, we want to really help. You know, we want to help from two perspectives. One, we're seeing the financial impact on our bottom line regarding this issue. And number two, we want to find out why they're not getting to where they need to get. So that partnership has provided a lot of information for us.
Jen, when you talk about things like the burdens placed on emergency rooms, you get the situation that I'm sure you run into again and again, where a lot of investment, increased investment up front would mean decreased investment, decreased cost down the line.
Exactly. A proactive approach to resolving this problem is essential. And we've been very reactive. We've been, you know, kind of chasing things around regarding enforcements. You know, enforcements, I understand, you know, the need to reserve public spaces for public purposes. But I also know that those persons that are being displaced through enforcements, they're not all going into shelter. And now we're, you know, they're being scattered throughout the community. And as I read in the paper yesterday, you know, the strategy for those persons is to go out of public view, is to essentially hide now. And so I'm concerned that we aren't going to be able to deliver the essential services that we need to those individuals.
I just passed a displacement on my way in this morning of a robust homeless community that was being moved along. And chances are, what, you know, ballpark guess, how many of them are going to end up sheltered from being moved out of a park today?
Well, at this point, I think when we see the statistics, you know, probably, you know, no more than 10% typically choose to go into shelter through these enforcements. I think as we work with the shelter providers and we work with the community to make our shelters a place that are welcoming to come, and I'm not saying that they're not, but obviously people are choosing not to go there, and we need to figure out why and what we can do to influence them to want to seek shelter.
Do those displacements seem cost effective in terms of the what it takes from city resources to bring them about?
It seems that, you know, it seems we could invest, put a lot of dollars in permanent housing, put some dollars in what we call bridge housing, which is a kind of a temporary situation as you're looking for that permanent option. But it puts a roof over somebody's head immediately so you can start to deal with the issues and help them start to get their life back in order. As we know, you know, housing and a roof over your head is usually the first step to being able to get yourself where you need to be as far as a person that's living happy and productive in life.
There would seem to be an intersection between the reluctance of people to go into shelters and mental health issues.
Yes. Distrust. Distrust is a, and you know, I have to say, I had a personal experience with a woman who had been discharged from an emergency room. I came across her on a weekend. She was a 73-year-old woman who's been living homeless for over 10 years. She had been in and out of shelters. And as I sat and talked to her, I kept saying, you know, why won't I let me call a shelter? Let me take you to the shelter. And what her comment parents were to me is they don't care about me. I don't want to go to the shelter. I don't feel trustful of them. So I think it's really about relationship building. And I know for people that have mental health issues and, you know, they've lost all of their support via family and friends, they've given up on themselves. Most people don't even think that they deserve care and services. And it's very sad. And it's up to us to remind them that they matter.
Jen, if you were sitting here with a, you know, public-spirited billionaire who said, what can I do to help you? Let me put a large number of resources at your disposal. What would you do with them?
Oh, well, obviously we'd invest more in permanent housing. Focused on permanent housing opportunities for those that are living at 30% of the average median income. Most of our affordable housing developments that are coming on board here in our community really are targeting those that are 60 to 80% of the AMI, which is essentially you and I sitting in this room. So I think it's really important that we're building housing solutions for those that are not going to ever have that income. They're not going to ever be able to afford to compete in the market rate here. So we have to have these subsidies, and we have to be able to make sure that we can provide these housing solutions. And so I would say investing in housing solutions. I would also put a call out to anybody that is a landlord out there. If you're a landlord and you own a rental property, it's really important that you don't have restrictions on your relationships with tenants, such as no vouchers. If you look at Craigslist today, you'll see that there are many listings that say no voucher. And essentially what that means is they're not going to take anybody with Section 8. They're not going to take anybody with a COC voucher or a VA voucher. And so what that basically says is, I don't trust you. You've experienced homelessness. That means you aren't necessarily going to be a good tenant. And quite frankly, that is an absolutely false perception. There's no evidence out there whatsoever that indicates that somebody that's experienced homelessness is not as good of a tenant as you and I.
I can hear landlords responding to that rather differently than you just described.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of responses do you get when you say that to landlords?
Well, I would say you need to show us the data. showing data, there is no data out there. I think it's much more about a misconception. It's much more about stigmatizing people and creating an us and them environment. Of course, you have to be a good landlord. You want to be able to meet your bottom line. You've invested in property. You want to protect your property. That's completely understandable. But you know, presuming that somebody that's experienced homelessness or who has come in hard times won't be a good tenant is really not a productive way of thinking.
Are we moving away from an us versus them
approach? I hope so. I really hope so. I see it in certain, you know, communities that we're working with. I think a good example of that is the LEED project, which, if I can get the acronym right, it's a Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And it is a pre-arrest diversion program in partnership with HPD. And it's basically working in partnership with them to provide other solutions than having to take people into custody or having to provide people with citations. Instead, let's work in partnership to create a solution and understand that somebody sleeping at a bus stop, it's probably a better idea to connect them to services than to provide them with a citation that will prevent them from getting housing resources.
Jennifer Stosch is the director of Partners in Care, whose 2017 point in time count after action report has just been released. You can link to it through the Conversation's Facebook page.
After a garment factory collapsed in Bangladesh, clothing brands from the West began talking about how their clothes are made. But it may be only talk.
These jobs, it is not with respect. These jobs is not with dignity.
Or with safety. Bangladeshi factories signed safety agreements with Walmart, The Gap, and JCPenney, but they can't be enforced. The story from Bangladesh on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Yesterday on The Conversation, we addressed the issue of medical marijuana and firearms. In a story first reported by the Star Advertiser, the Honolulu Police Department sent a letter to at least 30 patients using medical marijuana who also hold gun permits. The letter told them they had to surrender their firearms. Yesterday, we discussed the issue with Harvey Gerwig of the Hawaii Rifle Association, Carl Berquist of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii, and retired Associate State Supreme Court Justice Stephen Levinson, now a member of the Honolulu Police Commission.
I have gotten a ton of calls from people very upset that when they take medicine, now all of a sudden that medicine is causing them to lose a Second Amendment constitutional core right. And it is a medicine. The state decided that marijuana, for those that get the card, is a medicine. So if they take an opiate, do they come take their guns? No. But with a medical marijuana card, they do.
It's really about the stigmatization of these patients for taking a medicine. And from our perspective, the state is sending a really mixed message. On the one hand, we're hearing since 2000 that this is a medicine, as Harvey said. Go through the process, register with the state, get a card, you're in a database. It will only be made available to law enforcement for specific purposes. We were not aware that this was one of them. It's just really hard to understand why the state, on the one hand, is saying this is a medicine. On the other hand, is if you take this medicine, you are de facto not allowed to have a weapon.
We've never discussed it. It's going to be discussed at our meeting tomorrow. And I rather suspect that we'll be raising the issue with Chief Ballard.
The meeting referred to by Honolulu Police Commission member Stephen Levinson will take place at 2 p.m., and we heard from a lot of listeners during the live broadcast and afterwards via our talkback line.
My name is Erin. I'm calling from the Big Island, East Side. I was listening to the conversation, and if people are going to be on some sort of a list where police can look at that, who is regulating or seeing that these police are in compliance with the way they are searching and finding these people and looking this into this? I also have a second thing. I find it unreal that medical marijuana is looked at one way when opiate addiction is looked another way. I appreciate the time, but I don't trust the Honolulu Police Department or my own local police department. Mahalo.
My name is Sue Bennett, and I live near Pahoa on the Big Island. I would like people convicted of domestic violence, drunk driving, any kind of assault while drunk also have to turn in their guns. If people who are medical marijuana patients are expected to turn in their guns, the people who goes out Saturday night routinely, gets drunk and in fights and comes home and beats up the family ought to be the ones turning in the guns. Thank you.
We thank you for your thoughts. We'll be playing more listener messages throughout the week. If you have something you want to share, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and leave a message. Coming up, a look at the ebb and flow of citizen engagement. But first, your quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhawai.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of the man who brought the news of the Pearl Harbor attack to Hawaii radio listeners. Even people within sight of the aerial bombardment weren't sure what was going on until they heard him say, "Attention, this is no exercise. The Japanese are attacking Pearl Harbor. All Army, Navy, and Marine personnel to report to duty." On KGMB radio. He added, "Some people think this is a maneuver. This is not a maneuver. It's the real McCoy." He went on to a career with CBS Radio News during the war and was the only radio reporter on the deck of the USS Missouri on September 2, 1945, as a witness to the Japanese surrender. He had been the personal choice of Admiral Chester Nimitz, and as he recalled, "He knew I'd been in at the start, and he wanted me to see the finish." The popular radio announcer was also the longtime host of the music program Hawaii Calls. And this morning, we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689. or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Jude Hill from Kailua. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Citizen engagement in government as measured by such things as the number of emails and phone calls to congressional offices and attendance at congressional district town meetings went way up after the presidential election, generating predictions of a new era of individual participation. The numbers have declined in recent months, giving a lie to those predictions, and contributing editor Neil Milner is with us to try to figure out why. Why?
Why? Well,
that's my first question.
Well, one way to look at it is that they went back to more normal, but this is not normal times, and there's things that are going to happen that will probably affect it. Let's just go back and look very quickly. The study, the monitoring, is a kind of continuing monitoring process by a nonprofit called the Congressional Management Foundation that looks at the relationship between citizens and Congress and tries to run advocacy programs to teach citizens how to deal with it. And so they found that right between Trump's inaugural, let's say, and just a short time ago, there was an enormous increase in the number of people emailing their congressmen, the number of phone calls. Mm-hmm. And this was all what the foundation calls organic. This is not one of those organized things where someone sends you a letter and says, send it on. These were all kind of individual initiative or small group initiative. They also found that the increase in town meetings, this should not surprise anybody who watched those beleaguered conservative Republicans. Yeah. My favorite was Tom Cotton's meeting in Arkansas, have to face the crowds. The crowds were about five times bigger than the average town meeting. So what happened is you get this increase in a particular form of engagement. Remember, mm-hmm. we're not talking generally here. And then it stopped and it started to drop again. And the foundation is concerned, because this is their job, they're concerned that we might be moving back to a more cynical politics again. I don't think we ever left the sort of level of cynicism.
More
it's
cynical.
Pretty high. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty high. So that's what the study found, that it's increased. And it's consistent with other kinds of data about the increase in political ferment. There's been a fairly substantial increase in the percentage of people who are now paying attention to the news after Trump. Mm-hmm. Considering what goes on in my house, the following does not surprise me. Women are more likely to have increased their interest in news than men, and Democrats are more than Republicans. That translates into a Democratic-oriented woman sitting in front of the television set watching the news a lot more and being very concerned about Trump. So that's the kind of general situation we're in now, but things are going to change.
Well, you know, people in the Democratic Party who are concerned with the attitudes of Democratic women sitting in front of their television might ask themselves, where were they before the election?
Well, that's a more complicated sort of situation.
Yeah.
And that raises another kind of issue. What we didn't talk about here is ultimately what's going to be the next issue down the road, which will be voter turnout. This kind of participation doesn't automatically translate into increased voter turnouts for the midterm election. What we see now is that there are a lot more Democrats declaring candidacy for Congress than usual. There's really an increase, which suggests some kind of ferment. But it's a long way before November, and whether this translates into increased voter turnout, Democrats tend to have a disadvantage in midterm elections for turnout. And we know turnout can be a problem because certain kinds of people are less likely to turn out. So we don't know what's going to happen. You can assume that turnout is not going to change very, very dramatically compared to other ones. You can also assume we'll have a very low turnout here. But that's the kind of situation there. The other little factor here, there's a couple of things that that this foundation is way too rosy about because they don't talk about. One of which is that once you start getting close to elections, the big money steps in. In 2012, 60% of the campaign donations were given by 0.5% of 1%, half of 1% of the population. You have that sort of thing to have to contend with. The other thing is that they really didn't talk about other kinds of political participation, protests, and so on. They're interested in Congress, and they have a little section in their studying saying people were really too angry, and that you don't influence congressional people by being angry. That in fact, if you survey people in Congress, this is interesting because it's not the only way to look at this question. If you ask people in Congress, do constituents influence them? And yes, they do. If you look at other kinds of studies that haven't looked at surveys but have looked at the relationship between what people tend to believe and what gets passed in Congress over a long period of time, big surprise, it turns out that unless the political elites want something, it's almost impossible for, let's say, the lower half of the socioeconomic status to have much influence. You have more influence if you have a face-to-face meeting with Congress. Well, who do you think has face-to-face meetings? It's much more likely to be elites. So it's a more complicated question, but it's pretty clear that there is certainly a level of ferment and intensity and anger that we haven't seen since the Tea Party. And remember, the Tea Party was really kind of co-opted into the Republican Party very quickly.
Well, it was fueled by anger, and that's why your comment about anger puzzled me, because, you know, when I look back at certain social advances made in the country, civil rights, opposition to the Vietnam War, if those weren't fueled by anger of the bottom 50%, I don't know what they were fueled by, right?
Well, I think that's right, but there was something else going on in addition to anger. You had to know how to use your anger. If you look at protest generally starts in a way that's their view, that people get angry with them. And I mean, that's the history of civil rights.
Blocking traffic.
Yeah, a war kind of thing.
Yeah.
The other thing about the Tea Party was made up of a lot of angry people, but they were also made up of a lot of astute, middle-class, retired folks who had plenty of time, had some experience in politics, had plenty of time to devote to this, and channeled that anger into a willing source. At least it became more willing after a while, and that was the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty remarkable and exceptional situation about how fast that happened. There's a lot of anger directed toward the Democratic Party among the Democrats. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. In past elections, people have commented that, and I'm not sure if this is accurate or not, this is maybe just a subjective observation, Republicans find it easier to move in lockstep to a platform than Democrats. The Democrats, you know, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. Although right now both parties are going through some really
But that's been said.
It's been
right?
said. No, that's right, that the Democrats fight more. It doesn't necessarily – well, there's a couple things. They tend to come around during election time, first of all. And secondly, that also – you don't want to underestimate the historical, well, let's say the last 50 years at least, the tension between the libertarian aspects of the Republican Party and the social conservatives. That's sort of been reconciled.
Yeah.
And the Tea Party certainly began to reconcile it after a while. But I think that's right. The thing about parties, people identify with parties, but what they're really identifying with is a social group, not a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the average person can't tell you who the chair of the party is. Where the office is. It's not about that. It's a kind of social and psychological identification that's very stable and very, very powerful in the way we do politics.
Does it kind of have to hit you where you live before you get involved?
That's one way. You have to reinterpret things so that you see that's the way you live. One of the arguments that's made about why young people don't vote is because politics and government hasn't hit them where they lived yet. as you get older, you pay taxes, you have other kinds of things that links your own problems, your own situations with government. So I think that's the case. At the neighborhood level, it certainly is. We were talking earlier about NIMBYs. You know, you get some not-in-my-backyard thing, and people will just turn out of neighborhoods, whether it's parking or houses that are allegedly too big or whatever else.
Politics is local, right?
Well, it may be different, but it certainly is local and powerful.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
Sure.
Neil Milner is contributing editor of our segment, The Long View, and you can find a link to our Brookings Institute study on citizen engagement on today's edition of the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
As the need for public transit on Oahu increases, ridership on the bus, which is once regarded as one of the best systems of its kind in the country, is declining. The numbers are startling and reflect a national trend. They also raise questions about the future effectiveness of Honolulu's yet-to-be-completed rail system. Civil Beat reporter Marcel Honore has been looking at the numbers and has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Morning, Chris. Good to be with you.
It seems paradoxical, doesn't it? We've been hearing about the need for mass transit, and yet fewer people are riding the bus. What's going on?
Well, there's a few things at play here. I talked to Roger Morton, who heads OTS, which runs the bus for the the city, yesterday, and he, like other people, he points to in a good economy where you have lower fuel costs, you do tend to see ridership generally take a dip. But there are other unique factors at play here in this particular downturn. You have the ride-hailing companies, Uber and Lyft, although it's not entirely clear at this point exactly what impact those ride-hailing companies are having.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you also have visitor trips and tourists are taking a bit of a dive on the bus. Apparently they're renting more cars. They're using those private trolleys that you see. Apparently those are flourishing more and more, outside Waikiki, Kaka'ako, Kaimuki, those areas, and also college students are not using the bus in the same numbers, and that reflects some general downturns in enrollment on the island as well.
You know, the Uber and Lyft aren't going to stop growing, right? That seems to be a rapidly expanding sector of the economy. So what chances is there that this trend is going to reverse?
Well, you know, you talk to Roger and you talk to other analysts. You know, I talked to Shem Lawler, who's at Blue Planet and studies a lot of this pretty closely. Mm-hmm. They are confident that you will see things eventually turn around. And if you look at the data, going back to at least 93, and Shem would even point further back to 72, we really see a boom in bus cycles as far as the ridership. So, if you look at the historical trends, yes, we are in a downturn. Yes, there are, specific reasons for this particular downturn. But you talk to them, they are optimistic that things will eventually turn around.
Is the institution of the bus, able to keep up with, new buses, repairs, keeping its fleet kind of as modern as the riders might want?
Well, you know, I know they've had, as far as the actual bus fleet, it's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. But they have had issues with that with the handy van in the past and trying to keep up with maintenance and operation. But they are having challenges keeping up with capacity. Despite the declining numbers, the bus remains one of the most heavily utilized, if not the most heavily utilized, if you look at certain ways to measure it, systems in the country. So they really do, despite the declining numbers, they really do have their challenges keeping up with the demand.
Well, because it does seem as if resources are going toward the future rail system rather than the current bus system. I wonder if there's some competition for funding in those areas.
Yeah, you know, and resources are always, you know, tax resources are always finite on the island. What Roger and Shem will both say is once rail comes online, and I know this remains a polarizing and a controversial issue, but once it comes online, it should take some of the strain off the bus and even help it to run better. Rail critics, on the other hand, they'll point to the declining numbers and say this could spell trouble for rail ridership and our ability to pay for that system.
Well, it'll be amply studied when the time comes, Marcel. Thanks very much for checking in with us.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Marcel Honoré. The nation will mark the Pearl Harbor anniversary tomorrow as the day in 1941 that it entered the Second World War. But there's another day to commemorate, the day the USS Bofin, the Pearl Harbor Avenger, was christened, a year to the day after the attack. The Second World War-era submarine has long since been decommissioned and is now moored at Pearl Harbor as part of the Pacific Fleet Submarine Museum. Captain Chuck Merkel, U.S. Navy retired, is the executive director of the USS Bofin Submarine Museum and Park, and we spoke about the Bofin's contribution to the war effort.
Well, the Bofin was launched on December 7, 1942, 1 year to the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. She was then commissioned at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in New Hampshire on the 1st of May, 1943. She then came out of the Pacific, where she conducted 9 war patrols during the course of World War II. Her 9th patrol was conducted in the Sea of Japan with 8 other submarines that went through the Straits of Tsushima, submerged through the minefields. It was the first time that we had sent submarines into the Sea of Japan since the fall of 1943. Mm-hmm. These 9 submarines then dispersed across the Sea of Japan and at a set date and time started conducting attacks, as that was the last bastion for merchant shipping for the Japanese at the end of the war. Those 9 submarines then were scheduled to rendezvous at the northern end of the Sea of Japan and then came back here to Pearl Harbor on the 4th of July, 1945. 9 submarines went in, 8 came out. The USS Bonefish was one of the last submarines we lost during the war. The Bofin was on her way west in August of 1945 when Japan surrendered, and she returned to Pearl Harbor. And in the fall of 45, she returned to the East Coast of the United States, where she was decommissioned. She was then reactivated for the Korean War and got as far as the West Coast, but didn't deploy any further than that. And then after the Korean War, she served as a reserve training ship in the Seattle area and then was finally decommissioned in 1970. And she was towed out here to Pearl Harbor to be scrapped. Due to the vision of lots of leadership in the Navy League and World War II submarine veterans, they organized to save the Bofin and preserve her as a museum ship. And in August of 1979, she was formally transferred to the Pacific Fleet Submarine Memorial Association for preservation and then ultimately display. And she has been open as a museum ship since the early 80s at Pearl Harbor. And next spring, we will celebrate our 9 millionth visitor over the course of time.
Well, Chuck, going back to her glory years as the Pearl Harbor Avenger,
yes,
how important was submarine warfare in the Pacific theater?
Well, submarines were really the key to the victory in the Pacific. After the attack on December 7, 1941, the submarine base was not significantly damaged, and before the end of 1941, we were able to deploy 7 submarines out for initial war patrols.
Whereas the surface ships were severely crippled, our force was severely crippled.
Correct, and we also had submarines that were stationed based out of the Philippines. They immediately went on to war patrols as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we built over 200 submarines during the course of the war, and the submarine force was credited with sinking over 60% of the Japanese merchant shipping during the course of the war and 30% of the warships that were sunk in the war. So we really severed the supply lines that Japan needed for all the natural resources coming from Indonesia, Malaysia, for her to continue to her war production. So it really strangled those lifelines, and that was critical for the defeat of the Japan.
How large a crew did the Bofin carry?
It carried about 80 men.
And how difficult was service aboard a sub in the Second World War?
Well, it was if you come down and visit us, you'll see it was a very small ship, 300 yeah. feet long. The pressure hull diameter is 16 feet. And really one main deck from you can walk from bow to stern if you come to visit. There's other spaces below decks, but the main tour path is the main deck. The Bofin and all of our World War II submarines were really not designed to operate submerged for a significant length of time. They had to be on the surface to run their diesel engines and keep batteries charged. So once submerged, you could stay more than a day, but by the end of that, the air was fairly foul. There was no means of controlling the atmospheres like on our modern submarines today. And if you needed to really conserve electricity, you turned off all the air conditioning and everything else. So it could get very hot and foul inside the submarine.
What were the principal dangers to a submarine? What were the threats? Destroyers?
Certainly destroyers. We eventually came to realize to be effective, we had to operate on the surface to the maximum extent possible to have a more effective search for enemy shipping and other contacts.
Just to see a way around.
Right, that's right. So you had to be on the surface, so you're really dependent on your lookouts, watching for aircraft, and being able to submerge in less than a minute once you sighted something and felt threatened so you weren't detected. Because once you were detected, your speed and endurance submerged were very limited, so it was very difficult to get away.
And you were in danger from depth charges, right?
Correct. Once they became a main attack, that's right. Aircraft or surface ships could launch the depth charges or bombs.
How does a surface ship know where you are?
It would be some sort of cueing. If you were sighted, you could sight the periscope, or if you were on the surface, could be sighted and not paying attention. And then once they had sighted you, it was very difficult. You couldn't go very fast submerged.
Yeah.
To go fast submerged, you also made a lot of noise so they could listen for you with their passive sonar, or they could use the active sonar then to also detect you and then make an attack run.
What kind of speed could you operate at safely to get away from a destroyer?
Well, the Bofin and her other World War II submarines were basically limited to about a speed of 8 knots, 9 miles an hour. And your battery would only last about an hour at that speed, so you were very well pinned down.
That's kind of what I'm getting at, Chuck, is just the enormous risk of
yes.
being.
So the credible risk to be out there. It's a small ship, but it's a very big ocean. Even to be submerged, the sea pressure builds up very quickly when you go deep, and it's lots of day to day hazards.
We learned about the effectiveness of submarine warfare essentially during the First World War, right?
Correct. The Germans were conducting unrestricted warfare in the Atlantic, and that's what ultimately led to our entry into World War I.
Yeah.
And it really demonstrated what the potential of modern weapons, submarines and aircraft, could do, yes.
Were the Germans pretty much out in front in terms of understanding what submarines could do back in the First World War?
Yes, I think so. And then even at the in World War II, they were also the same, very effective with their tactics in the Atlantic.
Had we made a great many changes between World Wars I and II in terms of submarine construction tactics?
Well, I think that there was quite a bit of development. Diesel engine technology got better. Torpedoes were refined.
Mm-hmm.
So there were advances. I think some of the tactics envisioned for how submarines, that the United States would employ submarines, was not how we ultimately fought the war. So when we got into the war and it was ordered to execute unrestricted warfare, that was not something that we were trained and prepared to do. And it took a year, about a year to a year and a half to really sort out the tactics, get our weapons tested, because we had weapons deficiencies going into the war as well,
mm-hmm.
and get those things sorted out. So by the end of 1943, those deficiencies going into the war had been addressed and were corrected, and we began to be much more effective.
I'm betting that some of the visitors to the BOFIN today, Chuck, have served aboard modern nuclear submarines, and I'm wondering what kind of comments you get about the difference.
Well, we are much smaller in terms of the 16-foot diameter hull. The modern submarines are much larger, and the habitability has been much better addressed. Obviously, with the nuclear propulsion, you can stay submerged indefinitely until your real limit is food. You have the ability to monitor and maintain the atmosphere, and it is much more forgiving.
But submarines have definitely, over the course of the past century, proven themselves as instruments of modern warfare, yeah?
Definitely.
Captain Chuck Merkel, U.S. Navy, retired, is the executive director of the USS BOFIN Submarine Museum and Park. Tomorrow marks the 75th anniversary of the christening of the BOFIN, now moored at Pearl Harbor as part of the Pacific Fleet Submarine Museum.
I believe submarines underneath deep blue sea saw the flags Japanese.
Aloha, this is Louis Herman, author of Future Primal. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we look back to a sleepy Sunday morning in 1941 when the sound of aerial maneuvers was heard coming from Pearl Harbor. Most listeners to KGMB radio didn't know what those sounds meant until they heard the announcer say, "Attention, this is no exercise. The Japanese are attacking Pearl Harbor. All Army, Navy, and Marine personnel to report to duty." He was the manager of KGMB radio and the founder of the program Hawaii Calls, which began broadcasting Hawaiian music to the nation in 1935 and ran for 37 years. He became a war reporter during the Second World War and broadcast the Japanese surrender from the deck of the USS Missouri in September of 1945. He served in both the State House and Senate in the 1950s and retired from broadcasting in 1972. Many people with firsthand memories of Pearl Harbor Day remember that morning's broadcast and the voice of Webley Edwards. Andres Remedio was the first to get that right. Andres from Waipahu, congratulations for getting that Backyard Quiz right. And that's our quiz for today. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
For six consecutive years, HPR has been awarded the top four-star rating by Charity Navigator, the nation's largest charity evaluator. What does this mean to you? Well, it means that your donation to this nonprofit will be well and wisely spent. Make your smart and tax-deductible gift today, online or call us during office hours, select a monthly sustained giving plan, and you'll be making an even greater impact. Thanks and best wishes of the season.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and that's where Morning Edition host Derek Malama comes in. Joining us for a look at events going on in our community might be a little under the radar. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris.
This just into our newsroom. Tomorrow is Pearl Harbor Day.
Yes. Yes, it's the 76th anniversary.
So I'm told.
That. Yes. You've been talking about that for the past...
Yeah.
A few minutes.
Like I say, yeah.
Right. Okay, a parade in Waikiki tomorrow commemorates the anniversary of the attack. The parade honors the Pearl Harbor survivors, veterans, active duty military, and their families. A Cobra and Huey helicopters will be decorated with lights, joining floats and bands. The parade starts at 6 p.m. tomorrow at Fort DeRussy and heads down Kalakaua Avenue to Kapi'olani Park.
And if you're on Hawaii Island and have a taste for volunteerism,
yes,
an opportunity for you.
Tomorrow you can wear sturdy hiking shoes and long pants and help out remove invasive plants at the park. Bring a hat, rain gear, snacks and water. Gloves and tools are provided. No advance registration is required, and those no cost to do this, but park entrance fees apply. You can meet your project leaders in the Kilauea Visitor Center at 8:45 a.m. tomorrow.
At Hawaii Volcanoes National Park.
Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, yes.
And Pearl Ridge Center hosts a holiday handbell. I thought it was handball at first. Handbell concert tomorrow.
Yes, the Mele Mai Paki Lima Ensemble celebrates its 10th anniversary with a holly jolly Christmas concert. You can hear your favorite holiday tunes played on handbells tomorrow night at 7 in Pearl Ridge downtown.
I can hear them already. My ears are ringing.
Mine too.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That's a now-famous line from a film considered one of the best worst films ever made, The Room. We'll talk with James Franco about directing and starring in the new film, The Disaster Artist, about the making of The Room. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
Before we go, we wanted to add one more update about our conversation yesterday on medical marijuana and firearms. Late yesterday, the Honolulu Police Department issued a notice that it will not enforce that policy requiring users of medical cannabis to turn in their firearms. The department says it will consult with other government agencies and review court rulings about the issue. HPD Chief Susan Ballard released a statement saying, quote, "This is a new area of concern for cities across the country, and we in Honolulu want to develop a policy that's legally sound and serves our community." She added, "Formulating the policy will take time, but we want to do it right." HPD will continue to deny new firearms permits to anyone holding a medical marijuana card. And that's it for today's program. Up tomorrow, the Pearl Harbor attack seen through the eyes of a 6-year-old girl. You can tell us what you think or suggest a story idea to our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look under talk shows for the conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. And I'm Chris Vandercook. Thanks for listening.